Carl has the microphone, if you just wait for that. And David, you want to just field the questions yourself?
Sure.
Yes, I was delivering that talk from a pocket computer. And it's a lovely pocket computer, and I'll tell you all about it later. What was the first question? Yes.
Yeah, I see a couple of bootstrapping problems. Although encryption is being used regularly over the internet, what's being encrypted is basically credit card transactions, which are eminently traceable and taxable. And the two other problems, there's a long string of dead companies who have tried to do digital cash, and I don't see anything forthcoming in the near future that will be successful. And also, to deny the government tax revenue, basically both parties have to be able to spend the dollars that they earn in cyberspace. As soon as they get taken out of cyberspace, it's taxable. So you can't do even though you could buy something from IBM that's an information product and pay them anonymously, because they have very many feet in the meat space world, the government's going to tax them.
Well, but to begin with, you're assuming a world where every time IBM makes a transaction, they have to tell the government whether they know whether the other party is reporting it?
No, just that their income will be
taxed. Yeah, but yours won't. Yours will be only if the government could somehow use them, but since you might well be outside of the jurisdiction, they don't try to tax German purchasers of information stuff from IBM. So therefore, you're still free. IBM is being taxed, but prior to that, IBM and you would both be taxed.
Right. Yeah.
Well, except that there are limits, on collection and elasticity and so forth. My favorite counterexample is on the general issue of clearly impossible is always too strong a statement for the real world. But I'd like to point out that state governments are currently losing many, many million dollars of revenue due to barriers much weaker than this barrier. And I'm thinking about the problem of taxing interstate mail order sales. That if I know the situation in Illinois, I think it's true in California, but in Illinois, in fact, I'm pretty sure it's true in California. In Illinois, if I buy a copier from 47th Street Camera in New York, I am legally obliged to pay the state of Illinois a payment which corresponds to the sales tax on that copy. Furthermore, if I were so foolish as to again buy a copier when living in Illinois from 47th Street Camera, I might end up paying that tax because it happens that New York and Illinois are both parties to something called the Great Lakes Compact, which is a bunch of states on the Great Lakes that have agreed to share the relevant information. And the reason I know that was that I did buy a copier from 47th Street Camera, and to my great astonishment, got a bill from the state of Illinois for the taxes. Thereafter, I bought my high-tech stuff from Texas, which is not a party to such a contract. And if you think about the logic of the situation, the more states sign the contract, the greater the incentive to be the chiseler on the cartel and to be the state that doesn't sign the contract. So that's a case where, in fact, they have failed to collect large amounts of taxes because of a relatively smaller barrier. So I think that stands. As far as what's happening, George Orwell wrote a series of articles for an American magazine during World War II. And just after the war, he wrote sort of a summary, a retrospective article. And he said it was very interesting looking back because he got right the way things were going, but he always got wrong how fast they were going there. Because as an intellectual, he looked at the logic of the situation, as it were, but the world has a lot of inertia. So that may well be true. And I'm a little disappointed that we don't have, that Mark Twain Bank didn't succeed, that we don't have a digital cash system. My latest effort to jumpstart the digital cash movement is my solution to the spam problem, which I've been trying to get unsuccessfully published as an op-ed, which involves you're putting a price on your mailbox, 5 cents, say. And when somebody who isn't on your list of people you want to receive mail from sends you an email, it gets bounced with a message saying, I charge 5 cents to receive mail from strangers. If you wish to send me mail, here is the URL of the stamp machine. And the stamp machine is now a web page which sells anonymous digital cash in small denominations. And that means that the stamps are reusable, unlike the government's inferior stamps. So when you want to send messages to people who don't already know you, you just use one of the stamps you receive when somebody sent a message to you. And that seems to be a nice, innocuous idea. And if I can get it going, it's one way of jumpstarting eCash. And I think privacy advocates will be happy with the idea that these small denomination things are being done in an anonymous fashion, because you don't want to be able to trace people's letters back and forth. But of course, we can all do arithmetic, and 100 million 5-cent stamps is a lot of money. And, you know, computers multiply real easy. Maybe I'm wrong, but it does seem to me that the logic of things drives them eventually, and, you know, sometimes it takes a while. In the case of encryption, it's basically a network problem, that I don't want to encrypt my mail to you unless I know you're already set up to receive it. And there, what I'm hoping is going to happen is that two or three of the main companies doing email will get together and they'll agree on some standardized protocol so that we can make it all transparent. And basically, when you receive an email from somebody that's gibberish, your machine automatically writes back to his machine, say, please send me, you know, his public key with the certificate, and it automatically sends it, and thereafter is no problem. But we'll see. Lots of entrepreneurial opportunities here. Yes? Sure.
You talked about the Clipper chip. Yeah. Is that still happening? It's not happening. So the equipment, the infrastructure is built on the government side with the two-key requirement and all of that stuff, Justice Department and some other authority.
Interesting. As far as I know, that's a good question. Governments sometimes maintain things long after they're dead. And so I don't guarantee that that mechanism isn't there. But nobody's using the Clipper chip. There is no effort to get people to use Clipper chips. Maybe the government uses it for low security stuff. They were never going to use it for high security stuff. They knew better.
Is it true that the only company that was installing that as a function of some negotiation was AT&T?
I think that's right, yeah. But I don't think it ended up going anywhere.
Interesting.
Yeah. The next generation were proposals for key escrow schemes. For schemes in which you're allowed to have your own keys, but you've got to have your private key escrowed with an authorized agency. And none of those seem to have gone anywhere either. I'm a little puzzled about why Americans are as in favor of privacy as they are, but I'm delighted to observe it.
You mentioned that the NSA and the FBI seem to be picking up all of the emails.
I didn't mention that. The NSA has for many, many years been part of an international operation called Echelon, which intercepts phone messages. And, of course, phone messages might be emails. And I'm sure it intercepts emails if they go on the air presumably reads very few of them, but it uses it for traffic analysis and other things. The FBI has a carnivore system which, according to their description, which for all I know may be true, they essentially get a court order saying you can read all email to Mr. Smith from Mr. Jones in between these dates, and carnivore then looks at all email that passes the relevant nodes and filters those out. And that's their description. Now, I would have thought that you might also want to look at the email which had certain words in it, but they say they're not doing that for all that it's true.
But I guess what I'm looking from is the macro standpoint, and I'm trying to put a limit on kind of helping encryption just by it kind of the decay mode or of data. Is it if the government or entities are intercepting every email that goes on, do they have kind of a physical constraint of how long they can hold that data, because data storage starts to creep up and then all of a sudden you basically have a protection there?
Let me go back a step.
Okay.
First, they certainly are not in practice intercepting every email or every phone conversation at present. That would be very costly. On the other hand, one of the ways in which technology makes things worse is that we are getting good at speech-to-text technology, at programs which you speak to the computer and it turns it into words. If you think about wiretapping, the reason there is so little wiretapping is that it's very expensive. It's very expensive in labor, because somebody has to listen to that phone a whole lot of the time. All right, once you've got good speech-to-text technology, that problem disappears. Computers are much, much cheaper by the hour than FBI agents are. So it is becomes possible to tap a million phones, have it going to computers. The computers do speech-to-text. They then scan for keywords. They throw out 99.999% of the stuff. They tape record the rest. And when the right keywords come up, they call a human being over to read. So that means that one of the privacy threats is that the cost of wiretapping is much lower. And that's especially disturbing if you know that the CALEA, the Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, essentially required the phone companies to make it possible for the federal law enforcement to tap very large numbers of phones at once. And the FBI denied that they were planning to tap very large numbers of phones at once. They said it was just that they might want to tap 2% of the phones in some tiny area, so they had to have be able to have the capacity for 2% everywhere, and that's a lot of phones, but I don't know if I believe it. So that's a disturbing thing. On the other hand, it doesn't do any good to intercept stuff if it's encrypted, and so what we have to do is to get enough people encrypting so it doesn't stand out, at which point they can intercept it if they like to. Who cares? It's gibberish. Yes.
I'm interested in one aspect of the enforcement is sort of a transactional hegemon. For example, the Bank of International Settlements and their interest in getting taxation out of currency transactions. You've got your private currencies flying back and forth, and they've got enough clout through money to make governments per se write rules to keep the one man out from doing what it is that they're interested in doing and setting up a Grand Cayman Bank or whatever the heck it is that's going to do that. So it's kind of a game theory question as to how you see that shape.
But I guess the main thing, as in many of these cases, is it only takes one government to let you do it. It takes every government to stop you from doing it. That is, as long as you've got one government where people trust the institutions, Switzerland is an obvious candidate, then they can create a e-cash that everybody else can use. They get the seniorage on it, and that gives them an incentive to do it. So, again, I mean, obviously the U.S. government doesn't like e-cash. I wouldn't if I were the U.S. government. But it seems to me not impossible, but it's going to be pretty hard to block it from happening anywhere, anytime. That would at least be my reading. Yes.
This might be off the topic, but what's your take on Napster?
What's my take on Napster? I argued, I think, back in my strong privacy piece about 6 years ago, that intellectual property in digital copyright in digital intellectual property was not going to be enforceable much longer, just as a technological fact. You may be able to defend property in intellectual property, but not through copyright laws. That is, there is the possibility that technological protection may work well enough so that you can use the equivalent of barbed wire fences to protect your property. But it seems to me that once you've got lots of computer networking, it's going to be very, very hard to prevent widespread piracy of any kind of digital intellectual property. And I think that's what's now happening with music. And Napster, of course, was a bad design because it had a centralized system and therefore could be hit. But my understanding is that some of its competitors don't. And that with a decentralized system, especially with use of encryption, it becomes very hard to find anybody to sue other than the ultimate users. And you at least are a little reluctant to try to sue a whole lot of 14-year-olds for listening to your music. So yeah, I mean, that would be my view that you know, they can win in the short run, but I think they're going to find that if you want to make money by producing digital IP, you have to either work out an effective barbed wire system, which is what Intertrust, for example, is in the business of trying to do, or you have to make your money indirectly in various ways. That you could, for example, have a song which is given away for free, but you license a firm that wants to put that song into its advertisement. That firm is a real space entity. It needs your permission, and so you make it valuable by giving it away and then use it in that way. Or you give away the songs and then charge for the concerts. I happen to be reading a book that Bill Buckley published a while ago, which was a selection of his speeches over the years. And he comments in the preface that the secret that authors don't tell is that giving speeches pays much more per hour than writing books. And if you look at the history of people like Mark Twain, that was true then too. So that's a case where you use tie-ins, as it were, to get your revenue. And my guess is that that's the direction it's going. And, of course, I'm doing that quite extensively. That is to say, my web page has got the full text of two books and almost all my published articles. Three books, actually, one from my hobby that my wife and I wrote. And from my standpoint, I'm collecting my revenues not in money, but in spreading ideas I want to spread, getting a reputation, which gets me invitations to talk to nice audiences, even gets me a few free pretzels and one free book in this case, and other things of that sort. So I think that's likely to be the world. Yes.
Is not the interception of these messages by the government a violation of the constitutional defense, the requirement for search and seizure for warrants?
No. To begin with, there is no constitutional prohibition to prevent the government of New Zealand from intercepting U.S. phone calls. And the fact that the government of New Zealand happens to be an ally of the government of U.S. is irrelevant. The National Security Agency will tell you with a straight face, probably truthfully, that if their people discover that a phone call they have intercepted has one end in America, they will throw it away and won't listen to it. But of course, they have no obligation to make the Australians, New Zealanders, and English agents who are working in the next room do the same thing. As far as the FBI is concerned, the FBI's position in the matter is that Carnivore is working with court orders, and it is simply a way of implementing a court order that says that they can read certain mail, that's a warrant. I've, in fact, constructed an argument which, for all I know, the FBI hasn't quite made, though they've gotten close to it, which is that if you have a computer listening to tapping phones, you don't even need a warrant. The argument, which might, for all I know, fly, I'm not sure, is that as long as it's only the computer, that's like a pen register. That's something where no human being is listening. So what you do is you have your computers listening to 100,000 phone conversations. Seven of them, the computer reports to you. It doesn't say anything about what's in it. It just says it meets our search requirements. And your search requirements are a complicated filter depending on the words in it. So you then, no human being listens to it. We're assuming for a moment the FBI is playing by the rules. You now go to a court. You now go to a judge and you say, I've got these seven recorded messages that no human being has listened to, so I haven't needed any warrants yet. I now want you to give me the warrant to listen to those messages. What is my probable cause? The fact that my computer beeped. That my computer says it meets those criteria. Now, I haven't seen the FBI quite make that argument for Carnivore, but I'm not entirely sure it wouldn't succeed in a court, because you could, argue that, this is how you're deciding which things you want to ask for warrants about. Right? Anyway.
Sure.
About the model you were discussing in the first part of the talk about enforcing against fraud by using reputation rather than force, it seems to me that the market has already shown it, in the case of cyberspace in particular, that doesn't work. There have been at least two cases I know of online casinos in the Caribbean that were well reputed and did a lot of business and then all of a sudden closed their doors and disappeared with a lot of their customers' money. Because they had, as you say, only a cyberspace identity, nobody can find who it was and sue them.
Yeah. I'm afraid you have a stronger definition of work than I do. That I assume that all human institutions will sometimes produce undesirable results, and I assume that a working system of contract enforcement does not reduce the level of contract violation or fraud to zero. It merely reduces it low enough so that we can have a livable and workable society. Yes. Yeah, back there.
That would argue for pooled risk in the guarantor of
for what?
That would argue for the use of pooled risk in the guarantor of the reputation. Is that?
That is, if you think of, there are certainly going to be cases where you'll want insurance institutions, if that's what you're saying. Yeah, you might have, just like my bonding case, you might have organizations which themselves have large reputations. And therefore, at a price, guarantee other people smaller reputations.
What was the name of that 1971 book?
Machinery of Freedom.
Machinery of Freedom.
Yeah. I think it was 70. It was written in 71. I think the publication date is either 72 or 73. Other questions? My webpage, www.DavidDFriedman.com. All right, all done is one word, DavidDFriedman.com. If I'd only applied about 2 months earlier, I could have had DavidFriedman.com, alas. So, I didn't buy it. How much would I pay for it? That I don't know. The question hasn't arisen. But it's an interesting question. But in any case, so you will find lots of stuff there. Not all of it is political. If any of you are interested in medieval recipes, you'll find quite a lot of those there, too. That's one of my hobbies, but some poetry, some other things. But among other things, you'll find most of my published academic articles, all of my price theory textbook, all of Law's Order, although the version that's current is in the form of GIFs, and so it's about as good resolution as, say, a dot matrix printer. But it's supporting my system of virtual footnotes, which means that the icons in the margin of Law's Order, when you go to the web page, those icons are links, so they take you to additional stuff, which was my idea for that book, and selected chapters from other stuff and lots of articles. So, and even some of my Usenet posts arguing with objectivists and stuff like that.
See why David is so admired and well-read by many people. One other thing I might mention is that anyone who hasn't gotten his book or had your copy autographed, he'd be happy to, I believe, autograph copies here. There are copies upstairs for those who haven't purchased one. Also, if I could make another plug for something that we did here, this is a book that we published through New York University Press by one of our fellows, his name is Bruce Benson, called To Serve and Protect. And if you're interested in the ideas of private law and non-state organization, I think you'll find this to be quite intriguing. If there are anybody here who would like further information about future events, let me know. I want to thank everyone for joining with us, and good night.
I haven't read Bruce Benson's book, but I know Bruce. He's very good. A while ago, he organized a conference at the university he teaches at in Florida, and my comment at the time was that one bomb at that conference would have set the anarcho-capitalist movement back a generation.